Good morning.
Well, this morning I was planning to take our journey further in the life cycle to talk about elder tales, which are defined where the characters called, quote, old. So this would be like the last third of life, and the stories we've covered so far were the middle third. Actually, these were the first ones I worked on, because in gathering the stories, the ones that were characters were old were the clearest group as a distinct group. Then there were the ones where people weren't called either young or old, which turned out to be the middle age group, and then a large number about youngsters. Well, let me start off with a story from Arabia called Fortune and the Woodcutter. These stories are interesting because they go in a sequence and kind of show a developmental path through the last third. Once upon a time, there lived a man who earned his living by cutting wood in the forest. Every day, he took his two mules out, chopped wood, brought them back, and sold it for firewood in the village. Well, no matter how much he tried, he couldn't save any money to get ahead in life. He had three sons with his wife, and the three sons cut three times more wood than he did, but they ate four times more food. So he was no better off than before. Well, one by one, the sons left to seek their fortune elsewhere because they realized they weren't going to find it with their father. So the father and wife were left alone as they got older. Well, one day, the old man came home from chopping wood and told his wife, "I'm tired of going to work every day, running after fortune, working for her, but she never comes to us. So starting tomorrow, I'm not going to work." His wife thought it was just a passing fancy. Well, the next morning came, the sun rose, as it usually did. The old man woke up. Then he turned over and went back to sleep, as never done before. An hour went by, and his wife came up and said, "Oh, do you feel okay? Are you ill? Should I call a doctor?" And he said, "No, I've decided I'm not going to run after fortune. If she's going to come, she has to come herself here. She has to come looking for me." The wife was a little concerned about this, but said nothing. The second day, the sun rose as usual. The old man got up, woke up, turned over, went back to sleep. The wife came rushing up. "Husband, husband, you must go to work. We're not going to have any food pretty soon." And he said, "Well, I told you I'm not going to work for fortune anymore. She has to come here." "Well, you must be ill. Shall I get a priest, a doctor, a psychotherapist, or somebody?" And he said, "No, I'm quite fine." And he spent all that day relaxing, and the only thing he did, of course, was give food and water to his two mules. Well, the next day, the sun rose. He woke up, turned over, went back to sleep. And the wife came rushing up and said, "Husband, husband, a stranger has come by, and he's seen the two mules you're not using and asked if you could borrow them for the day." The old man thought, "Oh, well, talking to the stranger won't be work." So he went downstairs and said the stranger could borrow the mules as long as he treated them okay, gave them food and water, and brought them back safely. So the stranger took them off, went straight into the forest, deep inside. Now, he was no ordinary man, but an evil necromancer, whose brother appeared in a previous story. And by his black arts, he knew the location of a great treasure. He went straight to the treasure, dug it up, loaded all the gold and jewels on the two mules, and was proceeding, just ready to get back home, when he heard a commotion deep in the forest. And he looked and he saw the king's army was marching back from maneuvers, and he became frightened. If they saw him with the treasure, they'd ask how he knew, and one thing would lead to another. They'd find out he was an evil necromancer and burn him at the stake. So he hid the mules in a bush and ran deeper in the forest to hide. Unfortunately, he hadn't been a Boy Scout, and he got lost and was never seen from again. The two mules stayed there waiting and waiting for somebody to take them home. They waited all night. Nobody came. So they finally figured out they had to go home themselves. So they took the trails that were familiar from all the years of working with the old man, came back to the house, and started braying loudly for food and water. The wife looked out the window, saw them, ran up to her husband, said, "Husband, husband, the mules have come back and they have something so heavy, it looks like it's going to break their backs. Come down and take it off." And the husband said, "If I've told you once, I've told you 100 times. I'm not working." The wife ran down. She couldn't think of what to do. Then she had an idea. She grabbed the kitchen knife, ran to the animals, and slashed the bags to let out whatever was in it. Imagine her surprise when gold and jewels poured out. she said, "Go, Jules." Instantly, her husband was downstairs. They both stared at the treasure pouring out. Then they grasped each other and danced, because fortune had indeed come to the woodcutter and his wife. Any thoughts or reactions to the story? As you'll see, elder tales tend to be shorter and sweeter than stories about midlife. Well, the story has many themes typical of elder tales. It begins in poverty, or the old people are in poverty, and I think that symbolizes our fears of old age, of losing friends, family, wealth, position, physical health. The man is also a woodcutter, and it turns out that woodcutters are very common in stories about old people, and I think it symbolizes their ability or the task of going into the unconscious. If you notice stories about midlife, nobody was a woodcutter. They were generally in an urban setting, which makes sense because midlife usually busy with business and family and stuff like that. In the middle of this kind of dismal situation, where the old man has worked and worked and nothing has come of it, he decides not to work. What do you make of that? Now, what would you have done in his position?
Is this the same thing that Lustvig did? He left the corporate paycheck, which was impoverishing him, and started out on his own journey?
I think it's very similar. The difference is Lustig was kicked out, and the old man is voluntarily doing it.
Seems to me, rather than fears of old age, I understand poverty as that the energy has gone, and something new needs to arise. So to stop working is to make a change, and also by sitting inside, it's a time of introversion, so something new can be born.
This may be a little flip, but the thought that occurred to me, it's a little like retiring when you don't have a 401k.
But you buy lottery tickets.
Powerful.
I'd like to piggyback on what Penelope said, is that it's a time for introversion, but then from a symbolic point of view, it's the riches that come when people stop are the inner riches. You know? And she had to flash the bag, and sometimes we have to go into our guts or slash our subconscious to appreciate those inner riches.
Yeah, other stories will come to reveal the symbolism of the treasure, that it's not a material wealth, but a spiritual one. Well, let's try a little exercise. You close your eyes and picture yourself as the old man lying in bed. This is the third day you've not worked. And your wife comes in and says a stranger wants to borrow your mules. What would you do? What's your reaction? And when in your life have you been in a similar situation where you were on the verge of doing something that seemed crazy, trusting somebody you didn't know?
Right. Now I've lost my thought. But he has already said that he's waiting for wisdom to come, and so or help to come, and so in a sense he's open to all the possibilities that are there. Perhaps he isn't aware of what he is opening himself out to, but he's sort of, well, I'll take what comes and give what's asked.
Seems to me it's letting go of ego things and any possessiveness for a generosity and a trust for the self, with a capital S, to appear, perhaps, but anyhow, a letting go of ego and possessions and trust.
It's interesting. The story is sort of like wish fulfillment. A poor man gets all this treasure, except for one little detail, the mules. They knew the way back home because he had gone 20 years or so back and forth to work. And without that, they would have just stayed in the forest or wandered off. So it's actually not wish fulfillment, but actually a return on long labor for the magic reappearing.
Yeah, you asked what I would do, or each of us would do, and I must confess that if this happened to me, I would be very leery of loaning, you know, particularly if I didn't have much and I wasn't working. I think the only thing is he's already let go of his work, and that made him let go of this. But I mean, if I'm honest, I'd say I don't think I would have done it.
I'm amazed at how anthropomorphic we are when it comes to the divine. I think if I had that offer, I would think this is the hand of God. And who am I to deny the possibilities? I would say to the guy, hey, do you need a helper?
For some reason, it's hard for me to relate with the man in the sense that I have a car, and a car is not going to come back on its own. And, you know, the idea that people in the rural have that connection, we have lost that faith of connection. And it's, once it's given away, it is gone. You know, if I gave my car and they had an accident, well, too bad.
Is there anything in the story at all that tells someone on this side of retirement when that time comes for the necromancer to pass through?
That's a very good question. But in a way, the old man walking back and forth with his mules is sort of like the king walking back and forth in the cemetery.
If I may, I'd like to share a story I shared with Penelope, because the coincidences here are almost overwhelming. This morning, I had never told too many people this, but I had been a chairman for 25 years and for many reasons decided to step down and become just a teacher. So in many ways, I had given up a lot of the work. I decided not to work as hard anymore. And there was a man in my department who had made that decision possible. And he came and asked to use my car. And my first instinct was to tell him what he could do with a car, and then I thought, why not? It's only a car. He needs it, so use it. He had somewhat of a time limit because I was at a meeting, but he came back many hours later. And when he came back, he said, there's a problem. I need to go back to where I was because I took your seats out, so you're going to have to follow me to go back to this place to get your seats. I followed him, and when I drove up to the place where I was going to go, I knew that I had found my new home. And 4 days later, I owned the place he took me to. It was a place on a lake. It had trees. It was lovely. It wasn't even marked for sale, but I said, this is my home. And the man says, I'm selling it. I bought it. If I had not lent the car, if I had not followed him, I would not have found it. If I had not been prepared to buy it with 25 years of work and saving, I could never have purchased it. So in a way, my fortune came to me because my car was lent, and it came home and went back.
Fantastic. That's amazing.
Thank you.
And it can happen to any one of you. There's a great story that brings up the highlights the symbolism of the donkeys, and it's a grim story called The Ages of Man, or The Duration of Life. Long ago, when God created the earth, he created all the animals and gave them all the same lifespan, because he was egalitarian. He was probably a Quaker. Gave them 30 years. Well, the donkey came up to God and said, "Dear God, 30 years is too long. I know I'm destined to be a beast of burden. I'll have to work. I'll be beaten. I'll fed dry straw. Please take some years back." So God took 18 years back. Then the dog came up to God and said, "Oh God, 30 years is much too long. My teeth will have fallen out. I'll have sore paws. All I could do would be sit by the fireplace and growl. So take some years back." So God took 12 years back. Then the monkey came by and said, "Oh, dear God, 30 years is too much because, you know, I have arthritis in the shoulder, I can't swing, I'll be short-sighted, I'll fall on the ground. So please, take some years back." So God took 10 years back. And then guess who came but humanity. And humanity said, "30 years, that's not enough. We want more." And God said, "Well, I gave everybody the same. Oh, I do have some extra, though, that the other animals gave. You can have 18 from the donkey. 48, that's still not enough. We want some more." Well, I got 12 from the dog. Oh, yeah, that's 60. That's still not enough. We want more. Well, I have 10 more from the monkey. So you have to be satisfied because that's all the years I have. And that's why for the first 30 years, we're basically healthy and happy because that's the natural span of life. Then come the donkey years where you're beaten and you're a beast of burden, taken for granted. Then come the dog years where all you want to do is lie by the fireplace and growl. At last come the monkey years when you can do whatever you want and not care what people think. Should we go on to another story?
Yeah, right.
This one is from Japan and brings up a new task. It's called the magic towel. Long ago and far away, there lived a mother and her son. He grew up and eventually became of age to marry and married a beautiful woman in his village. He was quite happy, took her home to live with them. But this made a little trouble with the mother-in-law, because she was a little jealous of this young woman's youth and beauty. Because the mother-in-law had been beautiful in her time, but hard work in the fields and everything had taken its toll. Besides, her son was paying more attention to her than to the mother. So she made life very difficult for the daughter-in-law. She made her do the worst work, take out the garbage, get all the water, chop the wood and stuff like that. What made her even more angry, though, was that the young woman had such a sweet disposition. She never argued. She never got mad. And of course, this made the old woman even angrier. Well, one day, the mother-in-law made some rice cakes, this is in Japan, and counted them up carefully, put them in a cupboard, and said she was going to go on an errand, and told her daughter-in-law not to touch any of them. Well, then the old woman left, and the young daughter-in-law went around with the housework. Then there came a knock at the door, and there was a monk. This was in the days when monks went traveling house to house with their begging bowl for food. So the thoughtful young woman went to the cupboard, took a rice cake out, and gave it to him, because this was an honorable thing to do. And so the monk left. A little while later, Jesse came home, but the mother-in-law. She opened the cupboard, immediately counted them, and flew into a rage. "What have you done with one of them?" The young woman explained, "Well, I gave it to a monk. You know, that's what we're supposed to do. It's not enough that we waste food on you. You waste it on useless people." She became so angry, she said, "Go to the monk and get the rice cake back." Well, the young woman was afraid that her mother-in-law would have a stroke. She was so angry. So she ran out of the house and started looking for the monk. She searched and searched and finally found him high up in a mountain, sitting on a stone, watching, admiring the trees, as a good Zen monk should do. And she explained, she didn't want to say anything bad about her mother-in-law, so she said, I made a mistake and I need the rice cake back, if you haven't eaten it. And the monk took it out of his pocket and said, no, I haven't, you can have it back. And then he said, I know how life is so difficult with your mother-in-law, so I want to help a bit. And here's a present. Just use this towel whenever you wash up. Well, the young woman stuffed it in her pocket and ran off, thought nothing of it, gave the rice cake back to her mother-in-law, who was satisfied for the moment. But then the old woman started to notice that her daughter-in-law seemed to be getting more and more beautiful each day. And she wondered, how could this be possible? Because she was making her do all the hard work. So one day she decided to spy on the young woman. She woke up early and hid and watched her young daughter-in-law wake up, go outside to the stream to get water, get the water in the bucket, and then she paused and took out her towel, dipped it in the stream, and wiped her face. And with the first time she wiped, all the sleep disappeared. The second time she wiped, all the worries and care disappeared. And the third time she wiped, her face became even more beautiful than before. Aha, the mother-in-law said, my evil young daughter-in-law is having this magic towel and hoarding it all to herself. Well, I'll put an end to that. So that day, she sent the young woman on an errand, and then the old woman made a great show of cleaning up the house. And she went to where the young woman kept the towel and took it. When the young woman came back, she asked what happened to her towel, and the old woman said, oh, I threw out a whole bunch of rags. That must have been one of it. But from then on, every day, the old woman would secretly, in the morning, wake up, get the towel wet, wipe her face 10 times, and look in the mirror and think, oh, no change. But, you know, I'm older, so it probably take a little longer than for my daughter-in-law. This went on for some time, until one morning, her son asked, Mother, are you feeling okay? And she said, yes, I feel fine. Why? Because you're starting to look a little strange. And then he left with his wife to work in the fields. Well, the mother-in-law rushed to the mirror and saw that indeed she did look strange. In fact, she looked like a horse. She had a big nose and big eyes. And she was horrified. She got the magic towel, wiped her face 10 times, looked in the mirror, and it was a monkey's face. She was even more horrified. She wiped her face again, looked in the mirror, and saw it was a goblin's face. She fell to the floor in horror. What has happened to her? A short while later, her daughter-in-law came in the room, saw this goblin on the floor, and started to scream and run. When the mother-in-law said, oh, daughter-in-law, please don't go. You must help me. Something awful has happened. And she confessed that she had stolen the towel and had been using it. Well, the daughter-in-law figured out only the monk would know how to undo this thing. So she went running around the mountains looking for the monk and found him on another stone watching the trees. And she came up and explained the situation, and the monk smiled and said, oh, just tell your mother-in-law to use the other side of the towel. So the young woman ran back down. She told her mother-in-law that, so she turned it around, wiped her face, looked in the mirror. It was a monkey's face again. Again, wiped her face, the horse's face appeared, wiped her face, and then it was her own weathered but human face. Then she fell at the feet of her daughter-in-law and begged for forgiveness and said, as I sat here with a goblin's head, I realized how monstrous I've been to you. And so she resolved from that day on to be nice and kind, and so everyone lived happily ever after. Now this is a typical Cinderella tale, but with a twist, because the focus is more on the old woman than on the Cinderella, the young woman. And in the typical youth tale, the older person, the evil persecuting one, is killed or punished in some horrible way, especially in the Grimm's tales. But here, and in other elder tales, evildoers aren't punished, they repent and change. And that's a major new theme that appears in elder tales and also in middle tales, stories about midlife. Well, youth tales don't have that. You're either good or bad, and the bad people get killed eventually. And that reflects a major change in how we think of things as we get older. It's not black and white. There are a lot of grays in between. Any thoughts or reactions about the story?
Are there any tales in which there are evil younger people and abused older people?
Yes, there are. And the older people have to be very wise and actually tricky to survive. And what do you make of this towel? When the young woman used it, she became more beautiful, and when the old woman used it, she became more ugly. It's interesting because in a way,
It looks to me as if the towel brings out the inner qualities of the person and just exaggerates them.
The young woman was virtuous, kind, sweet, so wiping her face revealed her soul, and the opposite with the old woman. In a way, it's the opposite of the picture of Dorian Gray, where Dorian Gray had the secret magic picture, and he remained young and beautiful, and the picture became more and more horrible until he destroyed it and killed himself by doing it, because it was his soul.
The piece where the old woman must go back the path she came reminds me of the concept of unwinding in, I think it's cranial sacral work, that when you have an injury, what the therapist will do is work back through. And I had a case where I had strained some ribs, and the woman, the shiatsu practitioner who was working on me, said, "Tell me the story of how you got there." And I had to demonstrate for her physically what I did, and I knew the moment when it happened that I had done something to the ribs. And she said, "We have to take you back through the way it happened." And so she worked in reverse.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that the towel, yeah, that she believed that turning the towel around would make everything go backwards. And you know, those of us who've used towels know that both sides, you can't tell which side you use. I'm sure she used both sides. So I'm wondering how much of it was her belief system changed after he told her what would work. I mean, and the second part was her experiencing her worst fear, you know, that she was really ugly. She thought she was ugly when the story started, but the towel showed her how ugly she really was. It was sort of like a mirror. And I'm wondering, for those of you who know, I just heard a term this morning at breakfast, neuro-linguistic programming. And I don't know anything about it except what this wonderful man told me. But it sounds like the words that the monk used influenced her belief system. Maybe somebody could talk about that part.
This may take a couple minutes. I've recently been, as some of you know, I'm an amateur parapsychologist, and it has occurred to me and many in the field that people on the other side are given the option, not the option, but it's proclivity on the other side that you have a chance to revert to the best years of your life in the physical. Okay, you get the picture? You die at the age of 80 and you're wrinkled and a crone. When you get on the other side, it's your option, and it's expected that you will go to the best years of your life to carry on in your spiritual body. Beautiful picture. Recently, it came to me that someone who had passed over had started to go on into this process of reverting back into the best years of their lives, and it seemed to be very difficult for them to do. And in fact, as I heard the story, they were not able to do it. And then it occurred to me, you know, our physical life may be the same thing. That which we envision happens. And as we get older and we pass that 30-year demarcation, there's a possibility that what we're looking for now isn't programmed. We've been programmed by God up until our 30th year. Then it's up to us to program ourselves. And that indeed, what we start to do is we program ourselves by looking to the left and right and we see gray hair and wrinkles, and you say, oh yeah, 6 years I'll be that. By 10 years from now I'll have white hair, and you see how the projection is going. And we have become our own fulfiller of our own prophecy. And I thought, wow, if this is true, if we are programming our demise or our aged look, if we are programming it in that way, couldn't we just as well program it the other way? People shaking their heads. Afraid to. Well, I thought it is related to the story in as much as the 30 to 45 is our peak year. And I thought we revert to that. And your original story had something to do with that. And I thought, well, gee, it's worth sharing. And so I'm challenging you all. Start envisioning better skin texture, better hair.
Well, let's try a little exercise. Dear, close your eyes and picture yourself as the mother-in-law with the goblin head, and you're lying on the floor waiting for your daughter-in-law to come back. What kind of reactions do you have? What do you feel in your body? And where in your life has this occurred? Any comments, reactions?
I had a little trouble with the goblin head, but I was picturing, after 25 or 26 years of seeing many of the people in this room, I've seen many of us go from early middle age to wherever we are now. And I don't think it's just me, but I think there are extraordinary number of very beautiful people in this room, just as they are. I think Pagin is more beautiful now than she was the day I met her. I could say the same thing of, I'm looking at Hans, you know. Hans is certainly 30 years younger than he was when I met him. He's certainly more handsome and vigorous and present and robust. It's not just the women who are more beautiful. And I'm not saying that to sort of... I'm not discounting what we call the ravages of age. I think they're beautiful. I think there's something about who we are right now that's just right.
Well, I also had trouble with the goblin head because my goblin head, I think, came from my mother, and my sister particularly saw it on me. And almost 3 years ago, my mother died. And through a very strange miracle, my sister and I inherited the responsibility for my schizophrenic brother. And the result of that was that my goblin head fell off, because for the first time in my life, my sister had to work with me to care for my brother. And it wasn't only my brother, both my sister and my brother in the first year after my mother's death went through a suicide attempt. And those suicide attempts were the final completion, I think, of the goblin head falling off. And it's just incredible how my sister and I have become amazingly close in the journey now of sort of reviewing the dysfunction in our family and working on it. And although there's a long way to go, it's like I now have the family that I never could have as a child. And through this odd series of goblin heads being passed around.
Thank you.
you get to heaven.
The thing that struck me on this was the fact that the first two transformations of her were animals. And I think we're talking about beauty. On an animal, the faces would have been beautiful. A horse's face and so on would have been perceived by another horse or even by us as beautiful, but on a human, they weren't. So we're comparing parallel lives. And so it's a transformation not of the unbeautiful, but of the unfamiliar onto another thing. When it became a goblin is a humanoid type of thing, it became even uglier. And when it went back through the perceptions of herself as more beautiful than the animals, even though at that point she was an ugly person, and I'm wondering what this has to do in terms of our own grappling with race relations, with other cultures, is that we oftentimes perceive the unfamiliar or the frightening as ugly. When we become to know it, we become much more accepting of it. And I'm not sure what that has to do with anything, but I could just see the horse's face as being beautiful in certain circumstances.
I just would like to say one thing that I see by what I hear here, that beauty is really in the eyes of the beholder. And the person that said that thing to me, I see the young, beautiful maiden in that story.
Your question brought to me the fact that I'm choosing to find that ghoul's face of mine that in therapy before somebody looking on it. The old woman couldn't change until she knew the truth about herself. And I think it takes a lot of courage to enter into that and to find that that's, because once you do look at that side of yourself, then you can find also that there is a beauty there. It's like finding the shadow.
As a young man, I was terrified of my father. He was a very, very angry and a very bitter man. And that's a very, very long story. And I was very terrified of him, and I didn't want to be around him ever. And he had that kind of a face, a face of a gargoyle. And as he got older, he usually got uglier, and he became wizened and bent. And I went to see him when he was dying in Florida, and I was with him. I stayed with him, helped him. And as he was dying, and through the years, he could never compliment me, never once, because he had to be in charge all the time. And no matter what I said or what I did was never enough, never. I came to recognize that to a lot of help from a lot of people. And as he was laying on the bed dying, I was standing next to him and I was just waiting. He was 92. And he said to me, "You know, son," he said, "you are a success." And I could hardly believe my ears. It was the first time I'd ever heard him ever say that to me. He said, "You really are a success." I said, "Well, Dad, thank you." And then there was a moment of silence, and he said, "Only time will tell."
Someone mentioned neuro-linguistic programming. When that first came into the press, the two books were The Structure of Magic. One of them was The Structure of Magic, and I think it was More Magic. That was the second one. In those days, I was looking for more and better forms of magic. And I never made much use of neuro-linguistic programming at that time, which is essentially a teaching device for learning about self-hypnosis or any hypnosis. It wasn't until I came to a true spiritual belief that I didn't have then, and recognized that you have to let go of magic, let go of the belief in magic, and come to a recognition that you can't do it all yourself, but it requires something beyond that.
I think the story that's, emphasizes that, but you have to have the monk
let go of the belief
before there was a breakup.
Yeah. What are we and going go to another come, and go to exercise the spiritual there? Belief.
If everyone would close their eyes and picture yourself as the mother-in-law spying on your young, beautiful daughter-in-law with her magic towel, first discovering the magic towel. What's your reaction to that? And when have you envied the young? And what did you do?
I don't think you can do much of anything, really. I don't think you can do much of anything but just accept it.
I think the message is that we all have our gifts, and we maybe see somebody else's gift as the gift of beauty, and we once had that gift and we lost it. But I think the message about the old woman is to recognize your own gifts and to let other people also enjoy their gifts. And I think that when she was realizing her own dilemma, that it's like a song that says, we don't know what we've got till it's gone. I think when she saw how terrible things could become, then she looked back and said, being who I am is really a gift, and I should be who I am, and I should let my daughter-in-law be who she is.
The way that I think of this question is when I look at somebody else and ask myself, would I like to change places with that person?
Actually, there was a wonderful book written about it called In These Girls, Hope is a Muscle. And as the girls, there was an extremely talented basketball, two extremely talented basketball players on this team. And as they became more and more successful, more and more women started coming to the games. In fact, more and more people started coming to the games. And the girls' basketball team used to sort of draw the crowd that was waiting for the late bus, and suddenly you couldn't even get in the gym. And everybody started talking about what it was like to go to the high school and see these wonderful young women play basketball when we had, they even played a different game. You know, we bounced the ball twice and we couldn't go the whole court because right, it would hurt your uterus if you if you ran up and down the court. And my reaction was, at first I was, I thought, go to a basketball game? Ugh. And then I went to the basketball game, and then I thought, oh, God, I remember playing that game. And the boys had all this money poured into their sports, and we didn't have any of it. And then I started sort of feeling like I was one of those girls and walking around with a lighter step and just really enjoying that. And then I began to realize that I would never have that. And I felt extremely angry about what had been denied me. And I think that we all went, well, I don't know about we all, but I went through this process of finally then coming to really being able to celebrate what had gone on. And I think part of what made it possible to celebrate was that the girls themselves, when they became state champs and we were all sort of watching them, they were so grateful to their fans. And they gave back to us, and it's almost as if they redeemed us in a way. And that's what the story feels like to me. The young person redeems the older person. It's a gift. And to come to a place where you can really recognize it as a gift and put the envy away and just be happy, I think, restores the beauty.
Maybe one last comment. They're so good.
What comes to my mind is...
Stand. understand?
What comes to my mind is a quotation. It might be from the Bible, but I'm not sure. Rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. So I think that could, excuse me, that could mean mental health for any of us. If the mother-in-law had rejoiced at the beauty of the young girl and wept when appropriate, you know, if we could just enter into that with others, it'll mean health for us in many ways.
Well, should we go ahead and take a break, a 10-minute break, and come back? Because I have a fairly long story after we come back. But before we take a break, there's some announcements.